Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sane, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Natural Sciences Museum in downtown Raleigh, it's Friday, March 31st, 2017. This is the WUNC Politics Podcast. Thanks for clicking play. Time to review what was a chaotic week here on Jones Street, and here to help through some of the talking points and debate about House Bill 2 are Mitch Kokai, Senior Policy Director of the Conservative John Locke Foundation, and Rob Schofield, Director of Research at NC Policy Watch. Hello to you both.
Hey, good Jeff. Afternoon.
A three-part compromise to HB 2, House Bill 2, the bathroom bill, was agreed on by Republican and Democratic lawmakers yesterday. The governor then signed it into law. This agreement repeals House Bill 2, gives the state authority over multi-stall public bathrooms, and bans municipalities from passing non-discrimination ordinances affecting private employers until the year 2020. Rob, we'll start with you. Was yesterday a good day for North Carolina?
I think a lot of folks on the progressive side of the ledger, Jeff, are pretty upset about what happened with the HB 2 quote-unquote repeal. I think those who've had a chance to listen to Governor Cooper hear his argument that it was the best he could get, that it does make some minor improvements around the edges, but a lot of people are very angry, feel very sold out, feel that, you know, when the governor said in December that a six-month moratorium on non-discrimination ordinances was doubling down on discrimination, to then go around 3 months later and agree to a 44-month moratorium on non
48 months.
Well, it's from
me,
now.
You're right.
Yeah, 44. Whatever, 4 years. It's they feel sold out. They feel they have been fighting this fight passionately for a year, and then for it to sort of end with a whimper and an agreement to something that nobody feels very good about doesn't feel very good for North Carolina. And I'm not sure that the national figures who were counting on to come back to bring their ball games and to bring their concerts and to bring their jobs are necessarily going to buy it.
Specifically, what wasn't achieved in this deal that you think was attainable?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what was attainable. I take Governor Cooper actually at his word that maybe it wasn't attainable, but I think there are a lot of people on the progressive side who would have rather him gone on tour around the state and taken the legislature on and had a fight over this issue and a really knockdown drag out, let's really see who speaks for the people kind of argument. I think the polls showed that most people wanted a full repeal of HB 2, and to have such a modest, minor, tinkering around the edges, quote-unquote, repeal, I think has left a really sour taste in a lot of people's mouths.
One thing that struck me, and I guess it was just the latest reminder, is how moderate this governor really is in many ways. And I think those on the right, and particularly far to the right, like to say how radical he has been at times and liberal and progressive from my vantage point. Maybe it says something about me. I think this again points to how moderate he has been at times over the past few months. Mitch, was yesterday a good day for the state?
I don't know that it was a good day, but I do think it sets sort of a marker for where things are going to go moving forward. A lot of people, as Rob was just saying, on the progressive side were very angry with how things turned out. And a lot of people were very angry among those who were the initial House Bill 2 supporters. They didn't want anything to change. They wanted the law to stay in place. And they were especially angry that it seemed as if the leadership within the General Assembly was going along with Governor Cooper just because of some pressure from the NCAA. I mean, if you look at the conservatives who are talking about this, who were social conservatives, who were big supporters of House Bill 2, they're saying that people are putting basketball ahead of women and girls in locker rooms and bathrooms. So that's been their concern. I think those who didn't have a passionate sense of this bill, either on one side or the other, just wanted to see some kind of resolution. They wanted this taken off the table. Not sure yet whether it is taken off the table because of the fiery passions on both sides, but that is the hope among many people who would like to see the General Assembly talking about things other than bathrooms, transgender people, and protecting women and children in locker rooms and changing facilities.
Yeah, I think that's right, but I'm not sure it's going to happen, that they're going to actually be able to make this go away.
Mitch, what was learned over the past year and a week? What do conservatives, what do those on the right take away from all this?
Well, it depends on who among the conservatives you're talking about. I think among those who were the initial supporters, really the advocates for House Bill 2, I think they have learned only that the leadership within the General Assembly is not completely on board with them in terms of setting a policy like this in place and leaving it in place regardless of the consequences. I mean, the people who were asking the General Assembly to keep this law in place were basically saying, doesn't matter if the NCAA leaves, doesn't matter if the NBA cancels its All-Star game, it doesn't matter if you have any of these consequences, you're making the right choice, the right decision with this policy, and keep it in place. Don't change. Don't sacrifice your principles. But as they've learned, those within the General Assembly do listen to the people. They do look at the poll results. They do hear from business leaders who've been telling them, this is a bad deal. This is giving us a black mark. We need to do something about it. I think others within the conservative movement who were not initially supporters of House Bill 2 have seen that something like this can really derail the General Assembly from doing other things that you'd like to see them do. I mean, folks who are pushing for things to do with the state budget or education reform or regulations, they've been basically kind of sitting aside while most of this legislative session so far has been dealing with what do we do about House Bill 2? Caucuses for hours and hours on end of Republicans debating about what they're going to do. So I think a lot of people are saying, okay, well, we hope at this point that now this issue has been set aside. But as Rob was alluding to earlier, it's not entirely clear that it has been. I think until we hear from these national organizations like the NCAA what their response is, are they going to go along with this because it was something that Governor Cooper and the majority of the caucuses, the Democratic caucuses and the Republican caucuses, were willing to go along with? Is that enough? Or are they going to listen to people like Equality NC and the Human Rights Campaign and say, no, we need full repeal or nothing? We'll have to wait and see what happens with that.
What is a progressive takeaway from this whole saga?
Well, one of them is that a lesson has been learned again, that when you get into these very difficult negotiations at the legislature in which the governor and the higher-ups are you know, having these closed-door, high-powered negotiations, the folks in the civil rights community, the folks who are in the advocates for causes like equality, like civil liberties, probably aren't going to be on the inside. They're not going to be insiders who are in the middle of the negotiations when the push comes to shove. The people that probably are going to have the final say, who are the consultants that will be dealt with, are the money people, the corporations, the high-powered political experts and consultants, and not the advocates. And so that's a lesson that progressive advocates have learned repeatedly down through the years, and I think maybe they learned that again. They need to realize that they have a friend in many respects in Governor Cooper in the governor's mansion, but he's not one of them. He's not of them. He's not somebody who they can count on to always do what they think is right.
The third part of the compromise deal bans municipalities from passing NDOs, non-discrimination ordinances, until 2020 that would affect private employers. But as I understand the law, Greensboro, Durham, Raleigh, Wilmington, Concord, Kinston, whoever, could pass LGBT protections for municipal employees. I'm wondering, feel free to weigh in, either of you, are we going to see a slew of that? Are we going to see local governments in the next few weeks and months say, hey, we are protecting these classes and groups of people?
I think that that's quite possible. And it's also true, as Governor Cooper highlighted, that this could be made applicable to contractors as well. Companies that actually have business with those local governments could also, that could be the subject of contract requirements that they would also have to abide by anti-discriminatory policies. I think that's entirely possible and likely that will happen. We should also note that those non-discrimination ordinances that we can't pass now for 4 years also deal with public accommodations. So, you know, it's still going to be legal in North Carolina for, not only is it going to be legal to fire people because they're gay, it's going to be legal in, for private employers, it's going to be legal for people to deny, you know, I don't know, a hotel room or a cab ride to people based upon their sexual orientation. And there's nothing that any local government can do about it. And North Carolina as a state doesn't have any law preventing that.
Is that in line with what's the norm or what has been established at the federal level?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. There is no particular norm that's been established. We expect at some point that the Supreme Court is going to deal with this. And the hope of equality advocates and expectation is that at some point down the road, the Supreme Court and the powers that be will decide that we're not going to have this kind of discrimination in America. We're not going to be able to fire people because they're gay or deny them a hotel room because they're gay. But right now, it's a little unclear what the federal government has ruled. A large number of states have already ruled that you can't do that. Even states like Iowa and Utah, not thought of as liberal states, have policies that ban this kind of discrimination. But North Carolina is not one of those states.
I think it's worth noting that one of the reasons you saw that December 1st, 2020 date was that legislative leaders said, look, the federal courts are going to decide this. Let's let this play out. It will almost certainly be played out by December 1st, 2020. So something should happen between now and then, and we won't have to worry about this issue moving forward. That was one of the things, if you'll remember, that Pat McCrory often said about House Bill 2 after the drumbeat started to get it repealed was, look, this issue's in the courts. Let's let the courts decide it, and then you'll have an answer from the federal government. I think the other thing that's interesting, your question earlier referenced whether a lot of cities would come up with ordinances dealing with their own employees. I think that's true, and I think that probably would not have registered a huge outcry from the General Assembly if that had been what Charlotte and other cities had done in the first place, dealt with their own employees, set policies for themselves. One of the big objections that you heard from people who were pushing for House Bill 2 was these city governments setting rules that would affect outside private employers. That was one of the things that triggered them to say, well, wait a minute, shouldn't this be something that the state government sets rather than local governments? And I think if the initial ordinance from Charlotte had confined itself just to city employees and perhaps even just to city employees and contractors, that might not have raised the red flag that the public accommodations and other private entities in their communities did.
And across the state, I'm coming right to you, Rob, but across the state, county governments are often among the biggest employers. Isn't this an adequate start from your vantage point?
I don't know if it's adequate. It's certainly better than nothing. It's good to have local governments if in fact they do follow through and pass non-discrimination ordinances with respect to their own employees. That's great. And if they do it with respect to companies they contract with, that's still better. But I think the folks in Charlotte, what they were looking at, understandably, was, first of all, they had months of comment from their citizens who said they really wanted this. But then they looked at cities all over the country. They looked at Columbia, South Carolina, and Charleston, hardly in liberal bastion places, who'd passed ordinances just like this with no problem. There were hundreds of cities across the country that were banning discrimination in this way. And that's, you know, that's interesting. That's the idea that conservatives usually argue. Let's have federalism. Let's ideas percolate up from the local level, and we'll make law that way rather than having edicts from the national level. Now the conservatives want an edict from the national level. It's an interesting how that's turned around.
Yeah, I think the issue is that the concern among those who were not those who were working directly with the Values Coalition or Family Policy Council who had objections to having particular protections for gays was having these local governments set policies that affected private entities outside of their own governments. I mean, I think that was one of the things that triggered them to say, wait a minute, if you're going to have a policy that's going to affect these outside private companies, private employers, shouldn't that be something that's tackled on the state level so there's statewide consistency? You could certainly have an argument on one side or the other about whether it makes sense to have it at the local level or state level. But because this had not been addressed at all in North Carolina law, that was one of the things that really raised a red flag for a number of legislators.
That was their argument anyway. I agree with that.
Not to beat this drum for too much longer, but I mean, I've been covering this for more than a year now, and it's fascinating, not to sound insensitive to the religious right and the LGBT community, but I think there are elements of it that are fascinating, both as policy and the political tool. We heard from Chris Scrow several times this week. He is the executive director of Equality NC. He was appointed to a House seat last year after House Bill 2. He is openly gay. He's from Guilford County. He is he's been vehemently opposed to obviously House Bill 2 and then a lot of these compromise deals, calling them House Bill 2.0 at several different turns. Rob, the question I'm trying to spit out here is Chris Scrow and others within the LGBT community are upset with the governor. Where do they go from here? Is there someone in leadership in this state that they can turn to? Do you think we're going to get way ahead of ourselves? Are they going to run a primary against Cooper? I understand that we have this big spectrum of perspective. Where do they go from here?
Well, you know, somebody might have said the same thing after Amendment 1 passed, you know, and it seemed as if the possibility of having marriage equality in the state was, you know, way down the road. Well, they're just going to keep fighting, I think, is what they're going to do. They're going to work with the people who will work with them. There are a solid core of lawmakers in many parts of the state who voted against this compromise yesterday because they thought it was, you know, a sellout. So they're just going to keep raising heck. I don't know, you know, what this means for the 2020 election. I'm hopeful and expect that Governor Cooper will make a real concerted effort in the coming years to really mend some fences. He's got a lot of work to do. He says, I want full LGBT equality. I want to fight for it. Work with me to get it done. I'm really hopeful that he will try to do that. But, you know, this is a burden he's going to have to bear. He's got a lot of fence mending to do, and it remains to be seen whether the advocates – my expectation is that advocates will have different reactions. There's no monolithic block out there. There'll be different reactions from different folks.
Also on a political note, Mitch, I'm wondering what you think, if anything, about Dan Forrest. This is the lieutenant governor who I fully expect, many fully expect, to run for governor in 2020. He has been, as much as Pat McCrory, a staunch supporter of House Bill 2. He met behind closed doors with Republicans yesterday in the morning to urge them not to vote for this compromise deal. I wonder where he goes from here, and if you think that he'll continue to carry this, if this is part of his rhetoric moving forward, or if he's going to go in a different direction. And just to be clear, you don't work for Lieutenant Dan Forrest. I don't think you've had conversations right. with him in the past day.
No, not about this issue, and I'll comment on him, and also on Chris Scrow. You mentioned staunch supporter, even more of a staunch supporter than Pat McCrory. It mm-hmm. always appeared, even among the social conservatives who ended up giving Pat McCrory some credit for signing House Bill 2, that he was reluctantly behind this, that he understood the concerns about women and children in locker rooms and changing facilities and went along with that. But otherwise, he didn't really want a special session of the General Assembly because he figured legislators would throw other things into the mix, which they did.
Sure.
He ended up signing it. Forrest was much more gung-ho behind this, has not only supported it for the entire year that House Bill 2 was in existence, but even went to Texas and told the people in Texas, do the same thing here. Mm-hmm. See how well it's worked in North Carolina. You should do the same thing here. And I think he is going to continue to support that angle. That's going to be one of the things. Not only is it his principled stance on this issue, I don't see this as him taking on something for political reasons. I think he actually believes but it's going to help him with some of the social conservatives when he does run again.
I agree with that. And not to split hairs too much, but I want to stick with that word principled here, because this conversation about safety, and we there are many different ways to frame this debate, but the issue of safety, by and large, I think most people have moved away from that. And here we are, a year and a week later, we haven't seen any indication, and if I'm missing something, gentlemen, please tell me, but we haven't seen any indication that this is actually a safety measure, that there's not a need for protection of women and children. We've heard that from a lot of conservative lawmakers. Is this an issue of principle, or is this an issue of rhetoric?
No, I mean, that is the reason that Dan Forrest and those who are supporting this have supported it. You can tell them that they're wrong, that their concerns are baseless, that there's no reason for them to feel this way, but that is their attitude toward this, that it is a measure to protect women and children. That's the way they've approached it.
I really don't think so. I think Dan Forrest is a truest believer of the religious right. He is running for governor full-time right now. He and his allies use terms like transgender in quotation marks and LGBT in trans and sexual orientation in quotation marks. They literally don't believe that transgender people exist, that they are a legitimate class of people. And that's what this is about. This is about not allowing that wall to be breached. The folks who are the chief architects of HB2, the bathroom issue, maybe some of them believe it, but I think that's principally a smokescreen. This is about not allowing LGBT people to have the full rights that every other American citizen has. And I really think that's what this is really about.
I have on the screen in front of me the word legacy with a question mark next to it. And I was thinking about asking you both about the legacy of this all. It almost seems too soon to ask you about the legacy of this, because we just don't know what's going to happen from here, if there are going to be more policy efforts, how the courts will weigh in, if the courts will weigh in, so on and so forth. So I guess I'll deviate slightly. A final thought on House Bill 2 at this point, if you have anything else that you haven't said that you'd like to say.
Well, one thing I was going to get to on the issue of Chris Scrow and equality NC, I think one thing that hurt him and some of the other principal critics of House Bill 2 was that at no point along the line did they say, look, we understand your concern about this issue. Here's how it can be addressed. Other people did. I mean, other people, especially Democratic politicians, came up with some ideas for repeal or a compromise on HB 2 that had some things about stepping up penalties for crimes that take place in locker rooms and changing facilities. Chris Scrow and many of the people working with him right out of the gate said, this is the most anti-LGBT law ever passed in the history of mankind. It's terrible. It has to go. And as soon as they took that stance and did not deviate from it, they were not going to be a part of any compromise discussions. I mean, that I think Rob mentioned this earlier, that the advocates were not the ones behind closed doors. I don't think they had a chance at it once they said the only thing that's going to happen is House Bill 2 repeal.
Yeah, but I also think that the advocates who were opposed to House Bill 2 are not a monolithic block. Again, there's a diversity within that group as well.
Sure.
And I don't think it's quite fair to say that Chris Scrow speaks exactly for everyone, or that there couldn't have been a role for, you know, just to have an LGBT person at the table, which we're not aware that there was any, would make a difference in these kinds of negotiations. So
I think that would have been helpful.
Yeah.
Had there been one. But once Chris Scrow, who was the face of this after the fellow Chad Smith from Human Rights Campaign.
Yes, that sounds right.
The head of the Human Rights Campaign, once he sort of was off the stage and it mainly fell to Chris Scrow and Equality NC.
There's three out LGBT, two or three two. Out. Yeah, LGBT lawmakers, perhaps they could have been a part of the discussion. I mean, when you're an advocate for a cause, when you're a civil rights advocate, your job is to be a civil rights advocate. It's not to be a politician, to be out there advancing compromises. Although I do think there were many people on the anti-side who did support ideas like enhancing penalties and things like that on, you know, criminal bathroom behavior. But those were summarily rejected. They were never even allowed to be a part of the discussion.
Final thought for me, I'm going to tell a brief story. We're in a podcast, so I can do this, and I don't think that this has made its way onto the radio at any point during this week. On Wednesday night, when the Democrats got word of this proposal, Cecil Brockman, who is one of the two LGBT members of the General Assembly, was in a room off of a narrow hallway at the General Assembly, and he emerged from that room. I was, I don't know, 30 or 40 feet away from the hallway, and he slammed a door. He slammed it as hard as any of us have probably ever slammed a door, and it scared the hell out of a couple people. It scared the heck out of a Raleigh News and Observer reporter who went darting into the press room and went into our studio. He thought it was a gunshot. I was standing far enough away that I heard it, and it sounded to me as though a bookshelf had fallen on the ground or like a table had been tossed a floor down or something like that. Where I was, I heard it, and then I heard run. And immediately, I see Bill Brawley, who is a Republican representative from Mecklenburg County, sprinting toward me. And he's a middle-aged man. He's bald like I am. He's maybe a little bigger in the midsection than I am. But he's a bigger guy like me, and he is bolting to the front of the building. And he's with an aide. And I said, guys, what's going on? What are you doing? And they didn't say anything. And they kind of rounded the corner to go to the front of the General Assembly on Jones Street. And I'm walking toward them quickly at this point. And Brawley goes out of the building. And I said to the aide, I said, what's going on? And he spins around. He looks at me. He goes, don't ask questions. Get out while you can.
Goodness gracious.
And it was this wild moment that I don't know if it embodies or encapsulates or illustrates some of what was going on or a lot of what was going on, but it was just this wild moment of anger and fear and some people moving quickly. And we had a lot of that over the past year. We had anger and we had fear and we had people moving quickly. And this legislation did move quickly. So for whatever it's worth, that is my final thought for now on House Bill 2. Thank you for listening. One final thing from each of you, if you would. From each of you, one takeaway from this week in politics, totally unrelated to bathrooms and the bathroom bill.
I'll go ahead and start with the craft brewery industry. We've seen that growing in North Carolina, and one of the things that we saw filed this week was legislation that would raise this cap that forces the growing craft brewers to have to work with an outside distributor, something that dates basically from the post-prohibition era when North Carolina government decided that it needed to control all of the ways that alcohol was going to be sold and distributed in the state. And some of these members of this growing industry are saying, look, we're getting close to this cap of 25,000 barrels a year, and it doesn't make sense. I mean, our business model would suggest we could grow even more, make our own distribution, and be just fine. And they are running up against a very powerful lobby that's saying, look, everything's worked well. Let's keep the same system we've had in place. And you're seeing two different sides that are going to be jostling for position with lawmakers. The one side saying, this is an archaic law, let's get rid of it. The other side saying, no, it's worked just fine. And remember, we've been giving you a lot of campaign contributions. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that issue.
Yeah, I think both sides are giving a lot of campaign contributions in that one as well. So it's not just the big brewers. But the thing I'll take away from this week was the confirmation hearing that took place for Mandy Cohen to be the new secretary of DHHS. It was just a non-event in terms of we'd all expected fireworks. We could have expected them to be raking her over the coals about her past support for Obamacare. And instead, she proved herself to be sort of a rock star. I think she went around, met with each individual lawmaker, disarmed them, was charming in the committee hearing, really sailed through. It'd be interesting to see whether that happens with Michael Regan in the environmental, the Department of Environmental Quality, when his hearing, which was supposed to happen this week, has been postponed, we think, to next week. When that happens, perhaps he learned a lesson from that. We'll see.
Mandy Cohen pushed through with unanimous support, I believe, a vote for the next DHHS secretary will take place in the Senate next week. Rob Schofield is Director of Research at NC Policy Watch. Mitch Kokai is Senior Policy Director at the conservative John Locke Foundation. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.
That's all the news that's fit for air. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the WUNC Politics Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please share it on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe to the program using iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher for political stories throughout the week. Visit our website, WUNC.org. For Rob and Mitch, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. That your dreams came true. Guess she gave you things I didn't give to you.